You know, it's interesting, back a couple of weeks ago, actually probably a little bit more than that, I was going to say a couple of weeks, it's probably been closer to about 6 weeks, a statement was made by Mr. Franks. He said, stopping Sabbath services was easier than restarting Sabbath services. You know, when you think about what we have been through in the last 5 weeks, one would simply say that when we go back to March the 13th, it was very easy for me to send an email to everybody else saying, we are not going to be having local services in the four congregations of the Northwest. Nothing really needs to be done to stop services. Like I said, all you have to do is send out an email. Everybody reads it and says, oh, okay, we're going to be tuning into headquarters for a webcast. But to restart services, as we've done now in 5 weeks in Portland and Eugene and 3 weeks now here in Seattle and Spokane, we've had to restart with certain protocol. Where will we attend? In the case of Seattle, we have to attend in a different county than the county we were in because seating capacities are different, blah, 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 blah. You know the story over and over again. It's interesting to look at situations across the nation that religious worship services across the nation have been affected since mid-March and again this outbreak. I was reading something rather interesting, and this again goes back to something that I read in a Oregon Live news article from June the 22nd of 2020, that in eastern Oregon, there is a county, Union County, that has a church in which there was a 236-case outbreak. Now, that county is LaGrange, Oregon, which means nothing to you, but I can promise you it's in the middle of nowhere. I passed through it on Wednesday on my way to Baker City. It's a beautiful country, but it's very sparsely populated. But again, in this particular county, there was a 236-case outbreak. And as this article was stating, they said that there will be those that use that particular outbreak as an example to say, see, there should not be any large gatherings, churches included. Now, just in the last 5 weeks since we have restarted services in Oregon and again here in Washington State, we have seen in the news that there have been spikes in cases in several states, in Florida and in Texas and Arizona. Now, it's interesting that in mid-May, the administration of the Church of God, a worldwide association, made the decision to reopen Sabbath services on May the 30th. And so the whole time, whether you realized it or not, I was simply waiting for that go word that we would start. And to be honest with you, I did not think here in the Northwest that we would actually be starting as soon as we have. I thought that we'd actually be lagging far behind. In fact, Dallas, Texas, the second largest congregation that CAGWA has in the United States, only began their in-person services last week. That's, again, how late they had to go in terms of the local requirements in the county in which they meet. But as we look at everything that's happened, this outbreak of cases in a church in Union County in eastern Oregon, as we look at this spike of cases, and again, whether or not we should or should not have reopened on May the 30th, as we go through these past 5 weeks, we need to ask the question, have we made the right decision? Or let's ask it another way. It's a question that I'd like to answer today, and the title for the sermon, are we tempting God? Are we tempting God? Now, it was interesting, and prior to opening Sabbath services, if you remember Mr. Frank's sermon that he gave from the headquarters webcast that specific Sabbath, it was the sermon entitled The Still Small Voice, and he talked about Elijah, and he talked about fear, and he talked about the fact that there are circumstances that when having fear, it's not only good, but it is warranted. But it's when fear paralyzes us and prevents us from following God or hinders our relationship with God that it must be overcome. That it must be overcome. Let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 13 here for a moment. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 13. I think in terms of this whole situation with regards to the reopening of services, and again, as I said before, for those that are not prepared to meet yet, we understand and we respect the decision that an individual will make. But we also understand that if the argument is that I feel that I'm tempting God, perhaps we need to look at that question and evaluate it and ask the question, are we tempting God? given what we saw, as again, I'm just using one example of a church in Eastern Oregon and spiking of cases, are we tempting God? Notice Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 13. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 13, he says, "The lazy man says, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets." Now, it's interesting when you look at this particular proverb, because here we find an individual who simply says, "I can't go outside. I can't go out into the street because there's a lion out there. And if I go out into that street, I'm going to be slain." Adam Clark's commentary makes an interesting statement with this particular verse. He says the following. He says, "He will not go abroad to work in the fields because he thinks there is a lion in the way. He will not go out into the town for employment as he fears to be assassinated in the streets." In other words, the fear is so great that the individual just simply says, "It's not that I will be eaten, it's that there is a lion in the street and I know I'll be eaten." He's already determined for himself that he can't go to where he needs to go because the fear of that particular animal in the street hinders him from being able to do what he needs to do. Now, let's ask the question here, what is meant by this word or by this term, tempting God? Before we can answer the question, are we tempting God? Perhaps we need to understand what is meant by tempting God. I'll give you an example of what I believe would be tempting God. Now, we all know here in the Seattle area, there has been a 6-block area in Capitol Hill that's been cordoned off, referred to as the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, and then it was changed to the Capitol Hill Organized Protest. I have come up with a better synonym for it. I came up with CINOSS, C-I-N-O-S-S. That stands for Children in Need of Severe Spankings. Now, we laugh about it a little bit, but when you begin to read about what's going on there, you recognize and realize that this is just absolutely ridiculous in many respects. Pushing law enforcement out of that area and then deciding that you need law enforcement, or pushing everything, the businesses out of that area, and then demanding certain things from people whose property is not yours. Now, again, my point here is what is meant by tempting God? We all have sort of read articles about that. We know the violence that exists there in that particular 6-block area, and everything goes along with it. We know that they were responsible for literally pushing the police out of that precinct that existed there in the Seattle area. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment. Let me try and paint a picture for you. Imagine for a moment that I have a t-shirt on, and I put my coat on over this t-shirt, and I walk into the Children in Need of Severe Spanking area, also known as CHAZ or CHOP, and I'm in the middle of this area, and I take off my coat, and it reveals this t-shirt that in big, bold, capital letters says, "I love the police." Would I get out of there alive? Well, probably not. That's a perfect example of tempting God. I can't go in there and say, "Well, God's going to protect me from this mess." I would be tempting God. Now, again, I'm going overboard here, but you get my point when we talk about tempting God. Is God going to protect me when I'm a fool and an idiot? Well, of course not. On the other hand, does God often protect us when we are fools and idiots? Yes, he does. We all probably tell stories about situations that have happened in our lives where God has intervened when, you know, he didn't necessarily have to, but I'm going to do this because you're really being dumb. And I don't want to see you hurt. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul is going to refer to 5 specific sins that Israel committed against God. They tested God. They tempted God. Notice here, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, notice verse 6. "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." Talking about Israel. They're going to tempt God here 5 times as he lists them. He says, "And do not become idolaters as some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." Now all these things happened to them. as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So here Paul addresses five specific sins that they committed against God. And again, they were tempting, or they were testing God. Israel tried to test God's patience in the wilderness. They kept pushing, and they kept pushing God. It's almost as if you could hear them say, "It's all right. We're weak. God will understand." Will he? Will he truly understand when we tempt him, when we try him? Notice over in Matthew chapter 4. In Matthew chapter 4, we find again recorded for us the temptations of Christ when he was in the wilderness and he was tempted or tried by Satan. In Matthew chapter 4, we find the second temptation that is going to take place here. And it speaks specifically to this particular question that we're asking this afternoon, that being, are we tempting God? Are we tempting God? Notice we're going to pick it up here, Matthew chapter 4, beginning in verse 5. Beginning in verse 5. It says, "Then the devil took him," speaking of Jesus Christ, "up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone.'" In other words, just throw yourself down. Showing this an exceedingly high place. He's just simply saying, you're the Son of God. God is your Father. You have the ability. You can throw yourself down and he will protect you. Notice verse 7. "Jesus said to him, 'It is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God.'" You shall not tempt the Lord your God. Just truly throw yourself down. And if you truly are the Son of God, the angels will save you. Now, in this particular verse, the statement that is being made here is referencing Psalm chapter 91, in which it speaks to God's protection. Jesus Christ made it clear, though, here in verse 7, he says, don't tempt God. Don't show up with a t-shirt that says, "I love the police," in a six-block area that's been cordoned off by people that hate the police, and think that, well, God's going to save me. God's going to protect me. God's, again, Jesus' response here is clear. Don't tempt God. Just because the angelic realm is there to protect, we do not use it as a safeguard for doing foolhardy or foolish things. Now, again, as I said, we understand and realize that God's protection is given. I hope that that's something that we pray for each and every day, because it's not something that we should just necessarily take for granted. It's there, but it's also something that we should never, not always, continually, and daily thank God for. We understand and realize that the angelic realm is there to protect us in any one of a number of given situations. And as I said before, we can probably look back at our own lives, as I can look back at my life, and realize that I put myself in a stupid situation that's going to lead to a stupid conclusion. And it's only because God had mercy, again, that I was protected. Again, as I said before, we've probably all experienced the protection of God from situations we put ourselves in. Back in 2011, there was three of us that took a group of young adults, the Challenger Young Adult Program, and we went to the Grand Canyon in 2011, hiking from the North Rim to the South Rim. Once we came out of the South Rim, we made our way then to a lava tube where we did a hike down a lava tube, a mile in and a mile back, which was quite interesting. And then the next day, after a good night's rest, we climbed the highest peak in Arizona, which was Humphreys Peak, which sits a little over 12,600 feet. Now, when we were hiking in Arizona, it was July. And if you know anything about the weather patterns in July in Arizona, that is the monsoon season. That is when the rains come. And those rains pop up, and they come up as thunderstorms, and they can come and be quite severe. So we're leading this group of young adults, myself and three other staff members, and we were making our way up, and we got above the tree line, and normally that's at about 98 to 10,000 feet. You get above what's called the tree line, where it's nothing but rock. You've got the trees down below you. You're making your way up. You're going to 12,600 feet. We were going to go up there. We were going to have our lunch, take some pictures. Again, it's a beautiful, beautiful area to take a look in. It's an expanse where you can see Flagstaff. You can see out, you know, towards the Grand Canyon. A beautiful, expansive area. But as we're making our way up there, we're getting very, very close, probably no more than, I would say, a quarter to a third of a mile from the top. And here comes this front of thunderstorms that's rolling in. And you can see the flashes of lightning in the distance. And so one of the staff members that was more of a rock climber, and he is leading the way, and I'm more of an alpine climber where I do mountain trails hiking, and he's looking at me, giving me thumbs up or thumbs down, and I just went, yeah, go. So I went a little bit further, and again, we see another bolt of lightning, a clap of thunder. He's looking back at me going like this, and I'm like, yeah, but go quick. We get to the top. Everybody's taking a picture. They think we're going to stop, and the storm is rolling in. I said, nobody take their pack off. Take your pictures real quick. You've got about 30 to 60 seconds. That's it, and we're going back down. At that moment, there was a clap of thunder and lightning that was pretty close, and I said, that's it. We're out of time. We're out of here. We're scrambling down below the tree, getting back down below the tree line. As it was, we came down and we just got in below the tree line, and we're down there where literally a storm is coming right over the top of us. At that point, we were probably at about 9,000 feet. And at the same time, you've got, you know, young adults and for the most part, again, people that don't climb and don't understand some of the things. And if you've been wilderness first aid certified, as a few of us have, you know that there's certain things in a thunderstorm you don't do. Don't lean against the tree. Because the lightning strike is going to hit the tree and it's going to come right down through you. So you're telling people, you know, get off the tree. Why? Because you see that lightning or you hear that thunder and the lightning that's associated with it. If it hits that tree, it's coming down for a ground and you could be the ground that it comes down through. Now, stupid situation. But I believe that God's protection was there for us. I believe that God's protection was there for us in spite of our own situation where we should have just backed on down the peak before we ever got to that particular point. Everybody was fine. We didn't have any problems. There's no issues. But again, I say that that was God's protection. We know that God has promised His protection. Throughout God's Word, we see the protection of the Almighty in a number of situations. We have seen Him work miracles to protect His people. We have seen impossible situations of circumstances and deliverance at times when there simply was no way out. Over and over again. Again, God works and He promises that protection. Notice Proverbs chapter 18. Let's go over there for a moment. Let's take a look at three verses here about God's promised protection. Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs chapter 18. And let's look at verse 10. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 10. Proverbs chapter 18, and notice here in verse 10. He says, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. Again, remember we talked about that landmark, that monument you can see on a hillside, which is the law of God. We see the name of God is a strong tower. It's something that the righteous run to. They know that that's where God is. It's where His protection is. And so rather than running away from that, we run to it. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 25. Let's take a look at another verse here. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 25. So again, we in all of this that we're going through at this particular point in the message, I want us to understand that God has promised protection. And again, remember the question that we're answering. I want you to keep that in the back of your mind. Are we tempting God? Are we tempting God? Proverbs chapter 29 and notice verse 25. Proverbs 29 and verse 25, he says, the fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be safe. Fear is a bad thing when it becomes a fear of man. It becomes a snare, as the proverb says here, but whoever trusts in God, he is safe. He is safe. Let's take a look at one other verse here. Nahum chapter 1. Nahum chapter 1, again, one of the minor prophets. Nahum chapter 1, let's look at verse 7. Nahum chapter 1 and verse 7. sandwiched between Micah and Habakkuk if you're looking. Nahum chapter 1 and verse 7. He says, "The Lord is good, a stronghold." Again, we find the words that are being used here. They give us a good word picture. Again, we've seen the tower of God as seeing as that which gives us strength, gives us protection. Here we see a stronghold. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and He knows those who trust in Him. Do we trust in God? It says He knows those who trust in Him. Throughout the Bible, we have seen people try to test God's protection. Yes, you say this, but I need to see it. Let's go back to one of those famous situations where that occurred. Notice over in Judges chapter 6. In Judges chapter 6, we find, again, the individual by the name of Gideon. In Judges chapter 6, we find this mighty man of valor, as God refers to him. And he is going to call Gideon, and he is going to use Gideon as a way to deliver Israel. Now, again, the rest of the story, we don't have time for the whole story, but it's a fascinating story in my opinion. As you go through that whole story of weeding out those in this army of individuals, it shows a couple of things. Number one, it shows that mass multitudes and numbers of people, God doesn't need. What He needs is a small, concentrated number of people that are faithful in Him. Because they had literally thousands, and when it came down to drink the water this way, drink the water that way, and those that would run, those that would not do it, we come to find out that there were 300, or Gideon's army as we sometimes refer to it, of faithful individuals that had done it the way that Gideon said, God says this is the way it needs to be done. And they defeated the people through a supernatural miracle that God performed. But before we ever get there, we find that this person, Gideon, this mighty man of valor, tested God. He tested God. Notice Judges chapter 6 and verse 36. So Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel." He come to this particular point. And he's like, why are you using the word if? You know right away this is going to be bad when you start the sentences. If you are going to save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it's dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. He wanted a sign. Now, it wasn't enough that God said, I'll protect you. I'll be with you. Yeah, I know, but I want a sign. I want a sign. And so what ends up happening? Just as he did it. So it was when he rose up early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece in a bowl full of water. You think that would be enough? No, one sign wasn't enough for Gideon. The fact that God said, I'm going to do this, and the fact that he said, after Gideon said, well, if you're going to do this, could you do the following? That wasn't enough. In verse 39, then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Now, that's probably got more in it than we're reading right here. I'm sure he was trembling and fearful when he did that. Because God had already told him, I'm going to use you. And then Gideon says, well, if you are, I want to see the following. And God does it. And Gideon says, well, yeah, but that's not good enough. This time I want you to do it again. I want you to reverse it. I want the fleece to be dry and I want the ground to be wet. Yeah, have you ever wondered what God was thinking at that particular point? Yeah, is there anybody else around here that I could use? I mean, you got to wonder for a minute here. I'm going to use you, you mighty man of valor, after you're hiding in hiding from the Midianites. After I told you I'm going to use you, you want to see this particular miracle, and that's not good enough, you got to have another miracle. So not only did Gideon not want to see it, the sign one time, he wanted to see it a second time. Wow. Quite a thing from a mighty man of valor. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it be dry only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew all on the ground. You know, at that particular point, God just said, okay, here we go again. If that's what you need to see. You know, it's one of those things that I've sometimes asked the question that should we have waited for a sign from God that we should reopen Sabbath services? Should we have waited for a sign? What would that sign be? Should we have said when all states in the United States can get back to 100 people or less capacity? Should it be when we don't have to wear masks at all? Should it be when there's a vaccine and everybody can be inoculated? What would be the sign? In other words, if we were Gideon in that particular case and God says, okay, you can restart Sabbath services, would we say, okay, but can you do the following for me first? And then when God did it, would we say, yeah, that was good, but can you reverse it and do the other way now? Should we have waited for a sign? Notice over in Matthew chapter 16. Now again, I say this from the standpoint, again, of helping us kind of understand, again, the whole template of what we're talking about this afternoon is, are we tempting God? I think there's certain things that we could do that could tempt God. I think standing shoulder to shoulder, spraying spit on everybody as we sing, yeah, that's probably tempting God. But I think as we take precautions, as we do what we need to do, I don't think that that's tempting God, is it? We'll get to that in a moment. But notice here in Matthew chapter 16, again, talking about Gideon needed this sign, not just once, but twice. Notice how Jesus Christ addressed it with the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then the Pharisees, chapter 16 and verse 1 of Matthew. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and testing him, asked that he should show them a sign from heaven. He answered and said to them, when it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites! You know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to you except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he departed from them. His point was, if you're waiting for a sign here, you guys, it's a sign of weakness. Now, again, as I said before, we recognize we have God's protection, but it does not mean that we do not take precautions. On the other hand, we don't go into our foxholes and hide for a duration of months and months and maybe years on end until everything is said and done. It's not like jumping into a bomb shelter and waiting for the air raid sign to go off. It's all over and done. There's no bombs falling. Because I can assure you the bombs will continue to fall right up until the time of Christ's return. And the reason I know that is because prophecy tells us that. And you know that as well. So let's go back to this question. Are we tempting God? Well, again, let's put this together with the fact that we're gathering together here on the Sabbath. Because there's something about the Sabbath we have to go back and remember and rehearse for ourselves and be reminded of. Notice over in Exodus chapter 31. Exodus chapter 31, and I want you to notice beginning here in verse 12. He says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbath you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So we come to understand that by keeping the Sabbath, it is a sign between us and God. It is not the only sign, but it is a sign, and it's an identifying sign of God's people that they keep the seventh day Sabbath. Verse 14, you shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but of the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath and to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant, perpetual motion. If you understand physics, what do you understand? An object is put in motion until what? Until it stops. Perpetual motion means what? It does not stop until the person who put it in motion stops it. Sabbath is a perpetual covenant between us and God, going all the way back to Israel, all the way down through time, all the way through the New Testament church to current day. Verse 17, it is a sign. Remember what I said, not the sign, but it is a sign, an identifying sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. So again, we have a Sabbath covenant. It is a perpetual covenant. Now, Let's turn over to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23. Let's go to a couple of verses over here in Leviticus chapter 23. Now, again, in Leviticus chapter 23, we find the holy days are codified and written down for us and given to us. But let's take a look at what we see here in Leviticus chapter 23, beginning in verse 2. He says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations," I'll address that in a minute, "these are my feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest." That's what we're keeping today. "And within this holy Sabbath day is what? A holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings." And again, as he says, "These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in your appointed times." And then again, he goes through the holy days. Let's take a look at what is being stated here, because in verses 2 and 3, he uses two terms. He says, "You shall proclaim a holy convocation." What is a convocation in Hebrew? What does it mean? It means something that is called out. It is a place. It is a meeting. A proclaim means that you pronounce it, you announce it, you call it out. So we have a holy Sabbath day, and within that holy Sabbath day, from sunset Friday to sunset Saturday, we have a holy convocation. It is something that is pronounced. It is something that defines us. It is something that shows, again, a sign of God's people to their God. John 6:44, you don't need to turn there, but you know the scripture. It says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day." So this Sabbath that we keep, this 24-hour period from sunset to sunset, serves as an external and a visible bond that unites and sanctifies us, sets us apart from everyone else. If that's the case that I've made from Scripture, are we tempting God by being at Sabbath services in the middle of COVID-19? He's summoned us to be here. The law has indicated we can be here. Now, there's certain restrictions we understand, whether it's Washington State or Oregon or the various other states around the United States today, that they have to adhere to. There's some locations in the United States right now that aren't even able to have in-person services. They have not been cleared yet to be able to have in-person services. Question is, based upon the holy Sabbath day and the proclamation of a holy convocation, are we tempting God by doing what he's told us to do? I don't believe so. I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 8 for a moment. Matthew chapter 8. Now, in Matthew chapter 8, before we get to this little bit that we're going to read, we have to sort of set the stage here. In Matthew chapter 8, we're going to find that prior to what we're going to read, Jesus has healed multiple people. He has healed a leper. He has healed a centurion's servant who was not even there. The centurion, if you remember, came to him and said, "I have a servant. Please come to my house and heal this man." And you know, Jesus saying, I can't get there. He says, it does not matter. If you just say the words, you're a man under authority. I'm a man under authority. I understand. I realize as an officer of the army, if you just say the words, if you just say the command, my servant will be healed. You don't have to be there. You just need to say the words. Here's a man that understood authority. Remember Jesus Christ, he could not believe greater faith than this particular centurion had. And what happened when the centurion went home? He found out from that moment forward that Jesus had spoke the words. The servant had been healed. We also find that Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law during this particular time that he was healing individuals. We find here in Matthew chapter 8, though, in verse 18, we're going to come to the point where there's this multitude. And we notice in verse 18, "And when Jesus saw a great multitude," chapter 8, verse 18, "and when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side." So they're going to go across this sea, this large body of water. Now, I don't know how many people were there. I don't know how many boats they might have had. But this was not like they had a ferry to ferry all the people across. It's not like they had some vast boat with some 200 horsepower engine on it that they could cruise to the other side of the lake or the sea of water. They probably had several boats, and it was oar. It was man-powered horsepower, so to speak. So he's piling them in this boat and taking them across this water. He drops down into the body of the boat there, and he falls fast asleep. Notice verse 23. He gives this discourse on those that want to follow me, those that want to be my disciple. And he says, well, you know, you say you want to be my disciple. You say you want to follow me, but you got to understand, to follow me, you have to give up the certain things here. You're not going to have these creature comforts that you're used to. Oh, it doesn't matter. We'll follow you. So again, they get in the boat. Notice verse 23. Let's pick the story up there. Now, when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with waves, but he was asleep. Probably had those times before where you're just exhausted, you just fall asleep. The sea is churning here. Matthew's verbs is it's a tempest. Now, again, you got to remember something here. You've got four individuals. You've got Andrew, Peter, James, and John. They're all fishermen. So they understand the sea. So when they're saying that this is something that's bad, these are not people that are not unfamiliar with the waterways, so to speak, right? They know this is a bad sea. And so he was asleep. Verse 25, then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him? Now, you're familiar with that story, right? Familiar with that story. A great tempest comes upon the waters, and here's the four fishermen and said, we're going to die here. Somebody wake them up. Let them know what's going on. Can we go back to the beginning of the story here? Who was the first person in the boat? Jesus Christ. I ask you the question, do we really believe that Jesus would have purposely put the disciples in danger? Would he put them in a position where literally they would lose their life? Prior to getting in the boat, he gave a teaching on what it meant to follow him. Did Jesus, who had perfect discernment, know that this storm was going to come? Was he tempting his Father by putting them in a bad situation? Jesus used the event as a teaching tool for the spiritual principle of faith. Brethren, the Sabbath is a sign of God's people who have been called by Him. We come to understand and realize that those who are called and understand the special connection we have with God through His Sabbath. I do not believe that God is going to put us in a situation of causing us death when He has summoned us to a holy convocation on His holy Sabbath. Now again, I'm not going to say for a moment that people may not get sick from a virus. That's not my point here. But my point here is going back to the story that we just read here in Matthew chapter 8. Would Jesus purposely put them in a life and death situation? Would He purposely put them in a situation that would take their lives? Likewise, is God going to put us in a situation that would take our lives? Would God not protect us since we have been summoned to His holy convocation? Last week in Hebrews, we read about those through faith who subdued kingdoms, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, waxed valiant in the fight. If they had the faith to face those things, I believe that we can find the faith to gather together for a holy convocation on the holy Sabbath day. Let's conclude by turning to Proverbs chapter 91. Are we tempting God? Because that's been the statement that I made, the question that I asked us at the beginning here. Are we tempting God by holding Sabbath services? No, I do not believe that we are. Can we liken what we are doing to what Satan told Jesus to do, to throw himself down and test God's protection? Is that what we're doing? No, I do not believe it's the same thing, because I do not believe for a moment that what we are doing on this Sabbath day in this holy convocation is foolhardy. Can we have faith in God's protection and safety? Yes. Yes, I believe we can. Let's read Psalm chapter 91, verse 1 through 7 in conclusion. He says, "He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you."